Did you do that or did she?
Well, she did it. She acts on her own as well. That worries me too. What she might do when she's been exposed.
Exposed? To what?
Jeff, I've been so full of anger. I've had the most horrible thoughts lately. It's like vomiting up every resentment I ever had. Every ugly, vicious, sinful. It's what it is. It's sin. It's the desire to sin, Jeff. Fella's plugged into that.
Alan, you did not cause that fire. And neither did Ella. Animals are instinctively terrified of fire. They won't go near a naked flame.
Was that an instinctive reaction? Or does she just know what fire can do?
Christ. All right. I'll take her down to the lab and I'll run whatever tests that I can run on her. Although I don't expect to find sin in a urine sample. Sorry, Melanie.
That's all right.
Don't bring her back.
I'll check with you on Monday, all right?
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the invasion of the remake, or isolation of the remake, week 3-4, I guess we've been doing remotely now, not having everybody in the room, but it is what it is, and we're recording on Easter. Happy Easter, everybody!
Yay!
That was Sam Stepanenko in the background there.
Yay!
And he's cheering himself, which is really weird. Cabin fever must be set again.
You all know that I have a huge ego.
Trish Coughlin is also with us today.
Yeah, and actually completely forgot it was Easter. Everything is just blending together.
It's true. Everything is blending together. And the mastermind of the apocalypse himself is Jeff Omega. Welcome back, Jeff.
I am risen, I guess.
Was that a Rise of the Planet of the Apes joke?
You know, it's a joke we make all the time. Is making a resurrection joke on Easter too much?
Oh, see, what I always do is I watch Pet Sematary.
Well, it's also kind of inappropriate because we were talking about jerking off before we started recording.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, the French call the orgasm le petit mort, the little death, so you kind of are resurrected afterwards.
That's what kind of week it's going to be, folks.
It's
just going nuts.
Yeah, now we're further and further into isolation, and we're going to be getting weirder and weirder as it goes along. But I hope everybody
that was a smart bit of trivia.
I hope everybody had a good Easter. By the time you've listened to this, it's a couple weeks afterwards, but we hope you had a safe and happy Easter under the weird circumstances, and maybe video called your dinners or whatever. I know Sam's doing that tonight, so yeah, hopefully that works out. We're all finding different ways to connecting with our family and friends, and we are doing that via podcast. And guess what, guys? We're on Spotify now.
Yeah, we are.
Woo-hoo!
Right? We are now on Spotify.
It's the place to be.
Yeah, we finally got the show up on Spotify, so if you're listening, you've been listening to us for a long time and you know how to find us, and guess what, the entire library is on all those other platforms. We did have to yank first roughly 50 for Spotify, but most of the library's there after that, and YouTube is also one of those places where the entire library is not at, but you can go to any other podcast provider for the entire library, and subsequent episodes will pop up on Spotify as well, so follow us there if you've got a Spotify account. Now, this week we're going to be talking about Monkey Shines from 1988, and I've already got... Wait, that is some internet troll going, well, monkeys aren't apes and you have apocalypse. Well, guess what? You have no friends and this is why. Nobody likes you. Nobody likes you.
Yeah, I don't discriminate. I love all mammals that are close to humans in DNA.
Thank you. Yes, I feel the same.
I thought of a new name. We could call it Primatepril.
Primatepril? Primatepril. Okay, for those nitpicky guys, we'll call it Prime April.
Yeah.
I like it.
They can suck it that they've got that name.
So. So now that we've already batted away the internet trolls going, well, monkeys aren't apes. Yeah. Yeah, we know. We're doing it anyway. Get over it.
Why would we limit ourselves?
Why would we limit ourselves? Yes. And so we're going to be talking about Monkey Shines from 1988. I'd never seen this before. I don't know why I'd avoided it, but it's actually quite a good movie.
I'm excited.
It's a complex movie. It's a very loaded movie.
Oh, yeah.
And I was really kind of struggling with some ideas, and hopefully things will flesh out as we go. Sometimes it just happens on the fly, but I was definitely struggling with the ideas because it's a very strong story, and I would call this more of a thriller than a typical horror movie. But maybe George Romero was... more of a thriller director anyway, at least up to this point in his career. I mean, he was certainly associated with horror through his zombie stuff, and this was his second commercial release after Creepshow, which really turned him off on this one. We'll get into a little bit more of that later on. But yeah, my first watch, and quite enjoyed it. I thought maybe there's a lot of unnecessary complexity that could have just tightened up this movie a bit. But given the difficulty with shooting with monkeys in the first place, there was probably a lot of footage to choose from. And in the end, he didn't wind up getting the final cut. It was recut by the producers, and thus his return to independent filmmaking.
Yeah, that'll do it. Mm-hmm. That'll do it.
What about you, Sam? Was this had you seen Monkey Shines before?
Yeah, I had, actually. And I remember, I mean, I was only 18 or 19 when it came out, and I remember not thinking very much of it when it came out. I just don't think I got this particular type of horror. I just was too young for my undeveloped brain to wrap around. I really enjoyed it this time. I saw so many things that I would have entirely missed as a younger person.
How about you, Trish?
I think I might have seen parts of this growing up, but I think, like, just really sitting in and looking at it was the kind of the first time this time. And I mean, I enjoyed it, but when you look at the trivia and that George Romero didn't get final cut out, there's a bunch of holes and things I had questions about that I'm sure he answered, and I can feel it.
And you're probably right, and that's because of there's so many complexities and subplots going around that quite a few of them are left dangling because of it. And we'll get into some of those as we go along. But yeah, I noticed that too. And that's where it's like, well, we could have done without that and that and simplified. Like, it's overcomplicated in some regards.
Yeah.
Didn't hamper my enjoyment, but they certainly could have simplified it.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not saying I didn't enjoy the movie. I really did. But it was just some bits too. I'm kind of like, so they took out some stuff that would have explained things and left this in? Mm-hmm. And it just bugged me because
they'll set up a subplot that never pays off.
Yeah, it could have been much tighter.
Yeah, that's where they needed to tighten things up, especially with Jeffrey Fisher's boss in Dean Burbage. That subplot just kind of goes away, and it's further developed, and you don't get the payoff, and it's very frustrating with that. Now, Jeff, this was one of your top recommendations in the first place, so I'm assuming you'd seen this before.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually really, really like Monkey Shines. Yeah, it's a movie that I watched probably actually when I was around 18 or 19. It was one that a friend of mine had shown me, and I really liked it then. But again, watching it now, I think I picked up on a lot more, and there was definitely stuff I forgot about. But I think that, you know, to add to what we were talking about with all of the subplots, I haven't read the book yet. It's a pretty short book, and watching the movie, actually, I'm a little bit more inclined to read it now. I think that's one of the pitfalls of adapting a book, is that books have a lot of subplots. And I get the impression that it's not it's not an unfaithful adaptation, so it could just be that they were trying to get too much stuff from the book and they could have streamlined it a little. But overall, I really, really like the movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, given how much footage I think Romero actually shot, they probably could have made a 3-hour movie out of this thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, when you're shooting with monkeys and animals in general, they don't work the same way. I read that he had around 12 different monkeys, or 10 to 12 different monkeys, plus Tom Savini had made prop monkeys as well for an animatronic ones and with yak hair and stuff to round this whole thing out. Given how good the animal performances are, they must have been very difficult to make in the first place.
That's one thing that's very striking about the movie is mm-hmm. that the animal performance is very stellar. Mm-hmm. The animal in the movie is as much of a character as anyone else and mm-hmm. is as expressive. That's very hard to achieve non-verbally and with an animal.
Yeah, and when I was watching this, and this is one of the few times where we've done a movie with an animal, we've even done some within April, of course, where we've talked about a remake using some CG and motion capture. And this is one of the few times where I think that wouldn't work in a remake, where you actually need the physical animal on set, because you really wind up liking the animal, at least early on, because he's so adorable and with the hugs and stuff. And I said he on purpose because the animal actor, who was Boo, by the way, who plays Ella, it's a male monkey who winds up playing a female part. Normally, female animals, specifically with monkeys and stuff, are used because they're more docile. This was a rarity within film in general because of that. But that could be something we can work with as well. Who knows?
Well, and they're also less likely to go around marking their territory. They don't waste that time.
Right.
Like, the male apes are always pissing on stuff. So it's kind of like, we just need an ape that won't piss on everything.
Well, cats, dogs, they all do it.
They all do it. That's actually one of the major differences why they generally use females. It's because males, it's a big urination issue.
They even explain that in the movie.
Yes, they do.
And I like the way they did that, actually, because it kind of reemphasizes your point as to why they would normally use a female to play a female character. Mm-hmm. But Boo is funny. You mentioned how adorable Boo or Ella is at the beginning of the movie. And even at the end, that was probably the toughest point for me too, is the fact that even at the end, when she's the bad guy, as it were, you still felt for her because she was just attached to Alan. She wasn't evil. She just didn't want anybody else to be with him.
Yeah, well, that's one of the major complexities of the film comes around. Now, this isn't just a typical helper monkey that was developed. This was a lab monkey that had been experimented on. So we've got, like, experimental monkeys and a mad scientist who is utilizing a new drug that he's developed from the human brain. And it is developed some sort of telepathy or empathy within the monkey and the person it connects to. Now, we have the main character of Alan, who was an athlete who becomes a quadriplegic in an accident. Through the process of the film, we get the monkey to be trained as a helper monkey because Jeffrey, the mad scientist character, needs to get out of the lab because his boss is wanting results and is a schemer and is going to probably try to steal Jeffrey's work. So this is a way to get the animal out of the lab and hide his experiment. So he's lying to his friends as well as trying to save his monkey from being dissected, which is something his boss has an affinity for, is torturing and dissecting animals. And we got protesters in here, which is another subplot that goes nowhere. Although I guess there's an alternate ending on the Blu-ray that you can see where the character of Dean Burbage, the boss, does kind of get his just desserts as he's injected the formula in all of the remaining monkeys in there. And they kind of overpower his brain and when they trash the lab and basically murder Burbage, which would have been pretty cool to see.
Yeah.
That certainly would have brought more of the horror into it, because you're right, it's more of a thriller. I wanted to talk about the horror right at the beginning of the movie, and I don't want to forget about that, because you talked about how Alan's an athlete, right, and then becomes a quadriplegic. And that's the first 10 minutes. You're like, okay, there's your first part of your horror, is this person is very physically fit, and now all of a sudden he can't use any part of his body except for his head.
you're trying to quickly establish his identity without getting a lot. There's not a lot of dialogue. We just kind of saw him post-coitus working out naked, as you do.
Yeah, what was that?
I don't know. Put on some pants or something.
Watching like Die Hard 2, which came out also in the 80s, like, you know, Robert Patrick does naked Tai Chi at the beginning of that movie. Is that just like a thing that athletes did or do?
I guess if you want to show off the really muscular glutes, you got to have them naked.
Just that you get the best stretch if you have no clothing on in the morning, maybe?
Maybe. No restrictions.
I would only take it if it was like, okay, now we're showing them working out in ancient Rome, because that was the whole thing with the Olympics. They were naked. So I get that, but what is this?
I mean, in the movie, it is like maybe shorthand for like, we're showing you that this man is like, his body is in peak physical condition.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least when William Sadler did it in Die Hard 2, he was at least smart enough to close the drapes.
Oh, no, and this was a trend of like the late 80s, early 90s. There was like this sort of equality thing happening there, where they were showing men's naked butts a lot more, because I think a lot of people were tired of just of the exploitation of women and saying, well, hey, there's a naked woman's butt or a naked breast or whatever. Yeah. And now they started to show more of men's anatomy as a balance, maybe. I don't know.
I don't know. If I was that cut, I'd want to show it off too.
True. But yeah, this whole, the equality thing really wasn't a thing. If you're still showing women full frontal and I don't get to see a dick, then it's not equal.
Do you want to see a dick?
Yeah, actually I do.
Okay.
Watch Reanimator.
Yeah. But man, those naked corpses scared the hell out of me when I first watched that when I was a young teenager.
There you go.
Yeah, see stuff like that. That makes sense.
Yeah.
If you're going to make them naked, make them naked.
Yeah, well, I mean, in this movie, there's not a lot of nudity. I mean, you get to see his girlfriend's the side of her butt, and then there's one scene where you see like a shadow of a breast. I mean, his nudity was by far the most naked in the film.
Well, and I felt he was more naked actually in that moment where his mother is giving him his bath.
Oh, like that was actually I mean, you got a real sense of the discomfort, and his performance was outstanding.
Yeah, the lead actor in this movie, just incredible. Really good.
Well, we'll get into that. We're going to let Sam and Trish and Jeff just linger on the imagery of Jason Baig, I don't know how you pronounce his name, naked, while we run the trailer for Monkey Shines 1988.
Once there was a man whose prison was a chair. The man had a monkey. They made the strangest pair.
What kind of experiment was it, Jeff? What did you do to Ella? What did you do to me?
The man was the prisoner. The monkey held the key.
You want to be the boss now, is that it?
Stop it!
No matter how he tried, the man couldn't flee. Locked in his prison, terrified and frail.
Jeff, what is it? She's here! She's down here!
The monkey gaining power, keeping him in jail.
Ella, no!
Don't do it!
The man tried to keep the monkey from his brain, but every move he made became the monkey's gain.
Did you do that, or did she?
She did it.
That's right. She did it.
The monkey ruled the man. It climbed inside his head. And now, as fate would have it, one of them is dead. Monkey Shines, an experiment in fear.
We're back, and was that enough time for you guys to get off during that break? No?
Not my thing, Jay.
I love the poem from the trailer. What, masturbation is not your thing?
Well, not to Jason Baig.
Okay.
Why, is there something wrong with that? No, I'm just kidding.
Not my thing. I'm not criticizing people who
oh, shut up. Quit being so PC about it. Jesus.
Tell Jeff, quit picking on me then.
No, I won't, because I do it too.
Everybody picks on
to Jason Baig.
I had to run the board. My hands are busy. Maybe
it's
later.
Cold sweat.
The opening sex scene. was kind of sexy for not having any actual nudity. So, Jeanine Turner.
You know, I thought that actually is a really good example of eroticism in which you can portray something in a way that it's suggestive more than it is anything else, but mm-hmm. it doesn't need to be anything more than that.
Yeah, it's a very well-made film. I think this is one of actually Romero's best as far as a filmmaker goes. So yeah, this is based on the novel by Michael Stewart, and he's got a few other credits listed on IMDb. So if you've seen like Eye of the Storm, Midnight Edition, and Favorite Son, those were all him as well. Of course, the screenplay for this movie was also the director of this movie, George Romero. We've talked about George a couple of different times. First time was way back in episode 3 with a couple of different Jeffs, but neither one of them a mega.
Yeah.
And that was, of course,
Dawn of the Dead. I almost missed this one because I wasn't around for it.
No, that's right. You were not.
Pre-Sam.
Yeah, that was Jeff Alpha and Jeff Beta. I didn't come up with the Alpha and Beta yet, but that was pre-Omega.
Yeah.
And then we did talk about another Romero movie in episode 95.
Which would be The Crazies.
That would be The Crazies. So you can check out those episodes in our back catalog if you want to check out more Romero goodness. Yeah. Now, Jason Bay...
You haven't done Night of the Living Dead?
No. Well, the problem with Night of the Living Dead, it's been remade quite a few times, and that's a lot of movies to watch. So we may do some sort of special as more of an open conversation about it somewhere down the road, but it's a little tougher to talk about because there's a lot of movies for us to watch and they're still making them, so it's a frustrating thing when there's only two or three. It's a little easy when there's like 10. Then it gets a little tricky. But but we might do something for it down the road.
After our first outing where we had I Am Legend and Omega Man and like...
We did four in that episode. We learned really quickly that that doesn't work very well. And but we did do like a Christmas special on The Christmas Carol. And we just kind of went in our own directions and watched whatever versions we wanted to watch and then had more of an open conversation about the versions we watched. So we may do that with Night of the Living Dead down the road as more of an open conversation. So we can kind of touch upon all of them without having to watch everything.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this movie stars Jason Baig as Alan Mann, the main character, who's been in everything that starts with the title Chicago something. Like, literally, every Chicago thing. He was in Chicago Hope, and then he played the same character in different Chicago things, spinning out. Chicago Hope was a completely different thing, but then he spawned a character in Law & Order SVU, which then went into Chicago PD, Chicago Fire, Chicago Med, and Chicago Justice, because he's making a career out of being in TV shows that start with Chicago. Weird career goal, but good on you, man. It's a strange
career.
A strange statistic.
Do you think that he lies awake at
Chicago?
Night?
I just want maybe Chicago. Just think of maybe one TV series you could have, which would be like Chicago Suburbs or Chicago Little League or Chicago. This isn't going to be a horrible TV show where bad things happen to people.
Do you think he lays awake at night worried that he never got the part in Chicago?
Oh, the most obvious one, and he's not in it. That's terrible. John Pankow plays Jeffrey Fisher, and most people remember him from Mad About You. Kate McNeil was Melanie Parker, and you can catch her on House on Sorority Row, another classic. Joyce Van Patten was Dorothy Mann, who plays Alan's mother. She was in Trouble with Girls with Elvis Presley.
Ooh.
I know. When do I get to talk about Elvis Presley movies? Never.
That's twice in one day. I just saw this morning that Danzig just started releasing Elvis covers. So maybe Elvis is just in the cosmic consciousness or something. I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. I'll stick with Elvis. I'm sure that'll make Danzig fans... Danzig just rips everybody else off. I'm sure I just pissed off a lot of heavy metal fans. I am not a fan of Danzig. I met him once and he's a dick. And I don't care who knows. That is my opinion, by the way, so please don't sue me.
No, I don't think anyone would begrudge you saying that Danzig is a dick.
Yeah, he's a dick. I met him and his whole entourage and they're all assholes. In my opinion.
Entertaining sometimes.
Yeah, they are a unique group, that's for sure. Christine Forrest played Mary Ann Hodges. We probably mentioned her in episode 3 because she was also in Dawn of the Dead, also married to George Romero, so you can probably see her in a lot of Romero flicks. Stephen Root played Dean Burbage, and I think this was his first or second, I think this is his first recorded feature moving from stage to film. And his agent had told don't tell any casting people that you don't have any film experience. Just, you know, you're an actor, right? Just don't let them know that. So he'd recorded this first. I think there was another movie that came out just prior, despite being recorded like a month later. But this was his actual first full on acting gig, and he's now one of those guys that you saw that in that thing that one time. He's in everything. You can most recently have seen him in Get Out and Man in the High Castle. And I just literally yesterday, by accident, I've been kind of, because of the Picard series, I've been going back on Netflix and watching the old Star Trek Next Generations, and I just watched an episode with Stephen Root in it, and I didn't recognize him because he played a Klingon in the episode with Spock, the two-parter. So you can catch him in that as a Klingon, and that was kind of cool. And because he's so good at voice work, I almost didn't recognize him under all the makeup and stuff. It was pretty cool. And he looked different when he was young.
And I only just realized that he was Melvin in Office Space, too.
Yeah.
It was one of his most iconic roles.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, now that you mentioned that, like, alternate ending on the Blu-ray where he loses his mind, is Office Space the sequel to Monkey Shines, where he's already lost his mind and he's working at that place and he really needs his swing line stapler?
His red swing line stapler.
His red swing line. It's red. It's a swing line stapler. You have my stapler.
Am I a horrible person that I've never seen Office Space?
Yes.
Oh, man. It's so good.
I think you would like it.
I think I would too, actually.
Yeah.
Anything Mike Judge makes is worth checking out.
Okay, on to another guy here who's gone on to a hell of a career. Stanley Tucci plays Dr. John Weissman, and he's the one who performs the surgery on Jason Baig. And another crucial plot point in this movie, among a bazillion of them, is he's done this operation after the accident, and because of the damage done during the accident, he misses a medical condition which could have made Alan a quadriplegic at any time. So it was basically a misdiagnosis that was easily missed by this young doctor. And I'll be honest, even as a young man, I'm like, I do not recognize him as Stanley Tucci that I know today. He looks so different to me, but
he had hair.
I know, hair. Sort of.
So strange seeing him kind of in a movie where he is a relatively modern actor in people's minds, and like seeing him in an 80s setting that's very obviously 80s is very surreal.
It was, and we've only talked about him once before, and it wasn't even really an on-screen character because it was an animated character, but we talked about him in episode 150.
I missed that one, sorry.
Oh, well, that would have been our Beauty and the Beast episode, and he would have been in the remake. I don't remember which character he played, but there were a lot of big actors doing voices of those Beauty and the Beast characters in the remake. So that's the only other time we've talked about Stanley Tucci, but probably not the last time, because he's a very established actor who's gone on to some great things. So I'm sure we'll talk about him again. Boo played Ella, as I mentioned before. Boo's the monkey, and this was the only credited role I could find for Boo, but well done, Boo.
And she has an IMDb page, or he has an IMDb page, which is awesome.
Yes, that's how I know that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Janine Turner was Linda Aikman, basically the ex-girlfriend, winds up becoming the ex-girlfriend during the course of this movie. After the accident, she pretty much leaves Alan, a shitheel thing to do, and shacks up with with his doctor, Weissman. Another needless plot point to that overcomplicates this movie by a large margin. And as I bring these things up, it's like, good God, there's a lot going on in this movie. But
I disagree with you on that. That's an important point.
It's dog shit. Like, he didn't have enough shitty things. If she just left him, that was...
Shacking up maybe was a little bit much.
There's complication after complication. And this is where I find all these little plot points start hampering the film a little bit. But Janine Turner played that character, and we did talk about her in episode 147.
Cliffhanger.
That's the one. Yeah. Another actress in this movie. Like, I normally associate her with her short hair and stuff, and I barely recognized her in this movie. But her career didn't pop until after this. After this. So she was became a more mainstream actress in the 90s. Did go on to a pretty good career in the 90s. William Newman played Doc Williams, and you might recognize him from Mrs. Doubtfire and The Craft, but we actually did get to talk about him once before in episode 79.
Leprechaun.
Yeah, we've talked about Leprechaun. Go check out the library. Tootie Wiggins was Esther Fry. She was in Hot Resort. And Tom Quinn played Charlie Cunningham, and you can catch him in Super 8, which I notice is on Netflix right now. And I've only seen once, but I remember it being decent.
Yeah, it's good. Like, if you like kids riding bikes and aliens, it's a good movie.
Yeah, well, I guess it was E.T.
You know, it really was Stranger Things. It was really Stranger Things before Stranger Things, but after everything that inspired Stranger Things. That makes sense.
So yeah, let's get into this a little bit. I did mention some of the subplots there as well, because I felt like, you know, as I hit these characters, it might be a good time to mention what those things were going on. And there are a lot of them.
There are a lot of them. There's no question. I still think that the relationship between the doctor and his girlfriend was kind of important, because that's Ella's motivation to do her first act of violence. Right.
True.
Finding out that they had shacked up. Right. I agree it felt kind of like, well, shitty thing after shitty thing after shitty thing. But it also is Ella's motivation to do what she does.
See, and I thought there was something probably a bit more complex there that they didn't even touch on. Like, imagine if it's like a relationship that's sort of not completely working. And like, this happens and you're with somebody, and it's like, frick, I wanted to break up with them before this accident.
No.
And then you can't do it.
Yeah.
And I wished it would have been more like that.
And that would have been a more interesting story to me as well.
Yeah.
Like, and I got to argue with Samuel on this one a little bit, because yeah, that might have been motivation, but equally so, he was also really mad about the misdiagnosis, which means you could have used one or the other to justify that murder. Yeah. So one or the other could have gone and it wouldn't have changed much. So we had really a double reason for a murder. And part of it, when we talk about this too, is this union between this monkey and man, is the primal nature of the monkey was kind of swinging over to the man, the quadriplegic, with Alan, and vice versa. She would pick up on his emotions as well and needs. As a helper monkey, it would be like, okay, I can get this book and that sort of thing, but would go a lot further than that. And she would react to these other rages and needs. It's like, well, if every dark thing is coming up, well, to solve this problem, I get rid of the problem. There was a great kind of setup there when he's actually in class and the monkey raises its hand for him, not knowing that, like, you know, anybody else would think, well, how would the monkey know that he knew the answer?
And that's your first clue too, really, that there's more happening there, like sort of a more of a connection than just the animal growing sort of attached to her, like animals grow attached to people. She's very in tune with what he's thinking and what he knows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is a great and subtle way to start building that story. I mean, it does kind of sound a little cheesy when you kind of say it out loud. It's like, oh, psychic monkey. But
the way it's handled is really, really well.
Well, what I kind of had, I was wondering about, and this is what's bugging me kind of throughout the movie, is they sort of set it up. It's like, it's the serum that's making Ella smart. It's the serum that has something to do with this, because at the end, Jeffrey Fisher injects himself in order to get closer to the monkeys, which is a whole thing. But what I wondered about was, he's got this brain from Jane Doe, which he uses to create the serum. where did it come from? Do you think that might have something to do with it? It should.
In that, I totally love that. Who was this brain donor in the first place, and what was that story, and how does that influence? And that's goes back to the Frankenstein story of a murderer. Now, this was a case of the brain changing the physical body. Like with Frankenstein, the brain wasn't the person, and that monster was a lot kinder, even though misunderstood. Now, if you read the novel, not the nicest of monsters, but it's still kind of misunderstood. So this would be a way to utilize an old plot point in a very unique way.
Well, for sure. And it was kind of funny when you talk about Frankenstein, I actually was thinking of young Frankenstein. Because when Marty Feldman comes in, he's like talking to Gene Wilder. He's like, where did you get this brain? What was on it? He's like, it's Abby something. Abby who? Abby normal? And it was just, there's something wrong. Like, I would say that I would like it to be like, this woman has a past, and that ties into like the aggression and the need to like kill other people who are in the way. That's sort of what I kind of was thinking. It wasn't really a primal need. It was the fact that this brain serum came from somebody with a lot of baggage.
And that's a neat idea that I hadn't even considered, where you could go into, like, part of what made The Ring so interesting was digging into Samara's past. So if you start digging into the donor's past, that's an interesting idea for sure.
Yeah, she could have been obsessive about relationships, right?
Yeah.
Like that's like where she was sort of like a stalker kind of person, right? Or a Absolutely. He. I mean, you can flip it on its ear and have him be more of a stalker type.
And that's actually the simplest way I could even describe this movie. This is like single white female with a monkey.
Yes. Yes, it is. Can you imagine if they both got the same haircut?
I am now.
I think that's one of the really interesting things about the entire movie is, like we kind of mentioned it earlier, but Elena just really wants to be with him. Like, more than anything, like from a pet point of view, like he's the person that she's bonded with, and she's just acting out of interest for him. She doesn't really do anything selfishly, really, until quite late.
Mm-hmm.
It's like all stuff that like is to like make his life better.
For the most part, I wouldn't say that entirely, because with the whole do the task reward system, the monkey didn't want to be a slave to that. It wound up finding its own way out of this cage, stealing the treats, and just eating them whenever the hell you want. So, so when she did something for him, it was because she wanted to. And we do see that flip on its head near the end, where she starts feeding Alan the treats, going, hey, no, you're not in charge anymore. I am. I'm taking care of you, and you better start respecting that. And it's a really interesting way that happens. Like, it does kind of clumsily happen at the end, and I think maybe that's because of the cutting. I do find that third act is not as solid as the first two, and that's probably where the producer interference starts coming in the edit. It's built fairly well for the most part.
I didn't know much about the history of the movie, and I forgot to look up trivia about it, weirdly, for this one, but I didn't hear about the argument, I guess, over the cut of the movie. I had no idea. I thought it functioned pretty well as a unit by itself.
Oh, as far as the filming goes, I guess that went fairly smoothly. With the test audiences and stuff, that's when producers kind of came in and changed the ending. It wasn't supposed to have the happier and surprise ending as well. The stupid jump scare dream sequence at the end damn near pissed me off so much that I was almost like, fuck you. that one made me angry, because they never did it any other time, and I thought this was a nice subtle thriller, and then they pull out the one jump scare and I'm like, I hate you. I hate you for even doing it.
Even though you could see it coming a mile away, it was still annoying.
But it's, and then the they failed to give it the happy ending. He wasn't supposed to recover from being a quadriplegic either, according to the book, I guess. I didn't do too much research into the book, but from what I gathered, he didn't have the happy ending at the end.
Yeah, but people love their happy endings, especially the 80s. That was sort of like the happy ending time, right? Mm-hmm. But with horror, you don't want one of those. You don't want you want a little bit of tragedy at the end, even though your hero still comes out victorious.
Well, I mean, the setup was there. Like, it didn't feel super forced either.
No.
Even though Romero had intended to stay a little true to the book, the setup for the happy ending is also there with the doctor. And mm-hmm. I don't know if that was a reshot pickup or whatever, but the setup for recovery is already there.
Yeah, it was uh-huh. very deftly handled. There's no question. Mm.
I mean, even if you don't give it the full recovery happy ending, the thought of recovery actually happening is set up because he does make that one short move that saves his life and shows that, okay, if he really concentrates, tries really hard, he can get something moving, which means recovery could happen. And just if leaving audiences with that hope is a happy enough ending, in my mind.
Exactly.
And yeah. it's still ambiguous. And that's something Romero really liked, was ambiguous endings.
It was really deflating, actually, because you saw that you get the jump scare, and then you get the like the hokey music and him getting on the crutches, and it just mm-hmm. really kind of yanked you out of the experience you just had. Like, it felt like a completely different movie.
I agree. That's where I figure that the tacked-on ending happened, and I can see where George would be very upset with that. And given his history, he always kept his endings fairly ambiguous as to what the fate of the characters were going to be.
And what I found was it completely negated half the struggle of the movie, which was with him getting comfortable with or becoming used to losing that very physical part of himself and being able to be taken care of. Like, that's the whole arc is to him.
Oh, the emotional stuff is very compelling.
Yeah.
Yeah. That said, every person is really mean to him.
Sorry, what was that, Jeff?
Like, every person is, like, as shitty as they can be to him, like, to his fairness. Like, it's tough to be waited on, but every person also treats him terribly.
Yeah,
except for Melanie.
Yeah, except for Melanie, who comes in fairly late. Ooh. Yeah, his nurse is fucking Nurse Cratchit with her. And another needless complication was the bird. But at the same time, it's the first murder. You keep it minor, right?
I think that was the part that I had, like, the hugest problem with, because that nurse is terrible at her job, and it's just a bad thing. You don't bring your pets to a living kind of situation, A. And then B, his mother doesn't say anything to her. She's witnessed this nurse being bad at her job.
Yeah, if you're taking
say anything.
Care of a quadriplegic, yeah, bringing your animals into a live-in situation and letting them fly around the house unattended, that's terrible. I mean, the bird actually attacks Alan, and he can't do anything other than try to blow it off his face.
Yeah, and that's one of the few, like, really weak points in the body of the film that I found, was you weren't supposed to like her, but I don't think you need to dislike her as much as you did.
No.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I could see her being kind of impersonal but functional. This nurse is, like you said, Trish, terrible at her job.
Yes, she can't do it.
Yeah, and I don't mind a jealousy angle as a helper monkey comes in to take some of the burdens off of her, that building resentment maybe of her having to do all these things and not getting the thanks she should justifiably get. And now this monkey comes in and conflict happens there between her and the monkey, and I think that is enough, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
Other than trying to ratch up your dislike of her, like, it doesn't come off cheesy, but I mean, even Alan calls her Nurse Ratchet, so there's no bonding between the two.
I don't think
it took me out of the movie how angry I was at that character.
And I found the complication with the mother as well kind of bogged the movie down when she turns up to replace Nurse Hodges, Marianne. Then it just gets a little awkward and uncomfortable. Part of it's the emotional stuff as well. The embarrassing stuff with Mom kind of treating him more like a baby, where a nurse doesn't.
Yeah, I actually thought that worked. But I don't think they did a good enough job establishing their relationship at the beginning of the movie.
Yes.
To sort of make it work as well as it could have in the last half of the second act and the beginning of the third act.
Yeah, and I get the feeling some of that stuff was cut, because even Dr. John Weissman mentions that to Dorothy at one point, is you staying here is hampering his recovery. And this was, I think, after a suicide attempt.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it's also, there's this weird thing about it, because they make mention that she has her own business, blah, blah, blah. Again, somebody with their own business would talk to this nurse. But also, she's like, oh, I've sold the business. I've done all this, like, just to take care of you. Like, there's this weird type of thing where she thinks by doing this, she can go back and, like, redo the mothering she screwed up the first time.
Yeah, and I'd like to see more of that at the beginning of the movie, sort of established during the first part of his recovery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like, normally, she probably never wanted to be a mother.
Yeah,
and rules of the time said she had to.
And normally that would be a conversation between mother and son. It's like, hey, Marianne's put in her notice. Should I hire somebody else or do you want me to come out there? I have no problem selling my house and my business and moving in rather than just doing it.
But well, I think that establishes what kind of mother she was, though. She's kind of – she just takes liberties and makes assumptions about what her son wants. But I think you need to establish that at the beginning of the movie is that's who she is.
Yeah, they show that later when she comes around the second time. They don't establish it the first time, so when Dr. Weissman is telling her that you're part of the problem, we haven't actually seen that problem.
Mm-hmm. Not really, no.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, I almost feel like you'd have to have a conflict in which she tries to make a decision for him at the hospital near the beginning of the movie that he's not okay with to establish that that's something that she does because she thinks she knows what's best for him.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's already set up there. They just did a poor job of handling it. This is one of the few spots where it was poorly sort of written is when she announces that she's brought in a nurse. There's that whole opportunity right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean, that nurse was awful. But again, we make her, again, competent but unpleasant is what we really need her to be.
Yeah, just make her kind of cold. And she's also not kind of a fan of monkeys. Like, she probably thinks, like, oh, this dirty animal shouldn't be in, like, a clinical setting. Like, she has a good reason for not liking the monkey. Like, that kind of makes sense and doesn't make her cruel. She's just a very no-nonsense type of lady.
I think with her, it was to the point where it's like, why don't you just fire her and hire another nurse? Right? Like, she was so terrible at her job.
Oh, yeah. No, and that was my whole agony the whole movie. It's like, why the fuck don't you fire this woman?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? Why are you allowing this woman in your house and literally controlling your life?
When she's first set up, too, like, I didn't have that much of a dislike for her. Like, she clearly shows she's competent and good at her job. And she's just matter-of-fact, no-nonsense. And rather than being personal and bonding, we don't see her being kind of a shitty person until a little bit later. But you do get a sense that this no-nonsense might be a problem rather than just being cold. And maybe if they would have done that early on, because it was like, oh, okay, she's going to be a cold clinical person, but I didn't dislike her at the beginning. Only when things moved on later is when I started to dislike her.
Oh, I disliked her from the get-go.
I just thought she was cold and like, I don't know any of you people. This is how it is. I'm in charge here. I mean, there was a certain amount of domineering, but there were like everything was with the patient in mind. But it's also a new job for her as well. So we haven't seen her breaking the boundaries as of yet until the following scene when the bird's flying around.
Yeah.
Shortly after her introduction. That's when things like, okay, now we're starting to see what she's doing and she's going to make this place more her home than his.
Yeah. And actually, that gives me a thought on how we could sort of get rid of the bird but still sort of establish that animosity between her and Ella.
Mm-hmm.
Is she could be the first quote-unquote accident where Ella arranges for her to fall down the stairs. Or something along those lines where she has a tragic accident rather than her bird dying and then her moving out. I think that that would establish Ella's motivations a little bit better.
Yeah, maybe pattern of going up the stairs. It could be as simple as like, hey, the monkey deliberately pooped on that stair so she would slip and then fall and crack her neck.
Yeah, and it could appear to be an accident.
Yeah.
So we know, but or the audience knows, but nobody else does.
Yeah.
This is Ella's doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I also feel like to establish that he can make outgoing phone calls and for there to be a whole scene about that, I mean, she can even, like, the angle in which someone grows increasingly dissatisfied with their job and more potential exists for them to abuse the person they're looking after, it's interesting, but he needs to reach out to somebody or anything about it. And then be told that, you know, no or something. Like, I feel like
that would be his mother.
Yeah, exactly. He needs to make more of an effort to try to take as much agency as he can. Because really, we're shown that he can do stuff like make phone calls still. But he doesn't ever.
Mm-hmm.
Even to save himself.
And with modern technology now, you won't need those little drop-in cards like the movie shows from 88. We can have smart homes where it's like, okay, Siri, call this person. So, like, there are certain aspects. It's like Google Home, open my blinds, that sort of thing. That technology is there now, and it's a lot less expensive to do as well. That's something we can establish. I mean, they were already doing it in this movie anyway. We can do it in a more recognizable setting, but it also gives the monkey a little less to do as well.
Well, actually, maybe not. I was just thinking about this. Like, maybe you can have it established, like, the monkey knows about the Alexa and figures out, like, how to get it unplugged. Like, it knows where the Wi-Fi is. Like,
we do see it snap a telephone cord, chewing through the telephone cord. Now, we got wireless telephones, that sort of thing. So, yeah, if you chew through the Wi-Fi cord or whatever, it'd be similar.
Just turn the phone off or hide the phone somewhere where he can't find it.
Mm-hmm. Where the fuse box is.
One morning and the phone is broken or something. It's fallen off of the
phone or something like that.
Yeah.
You could actually have a really fun scene there where you sort of show her doing all these things before the climax of the film where she's turning off the cell phone or breaking it and turning off the router and the power and all that. I think that'd be really interesting.
The cell phone would be easier to handle than the full 80s phones, you could just have her smashing it on the corner of a coffee table or something like that.
Yeah.
That violent act would be something we would associate as well. It would be a visceral thing for the audience.
So I think that the kind of the balance of the story, even though it maybe wasn't as present, I kind of feel like if you were going to do a remake, the story is like somebody who has agency and they have their agency taken away from them. And I feel like for a story, he should be in a position where he's trying to make decisions and his mother is ignoring him. He just feels more and more helpless, but Ella's like maybe his outlet to not feel helpless, but it's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. I think they missed an opportunity there for everybody to sort of treat him as not just physically disabled, but mentally disabled.
Yeah.
And they kind of steamroller over him. I think that's where you're going there, Jeff. And whereas he's like, no, my brain still works.
Yeah. Right?
And that's where the law school kind of establishes that. It's like, I'm still as smart as I ever was. I just can't do the physical things I used to do.
Yeah. Well, I did enjoy like the early part. Well, maybe not enjoy. I reacted to the way I think Romero intended is we see those stages of grief and acceptance at the beginning of the film with the attempted suicide and depression early on before the monkey actually helps him with acceptance and saying, hey, I actually have an animal that cares about me and I'm bonding with, as well as I can actually function in this world and have a purpose. And when he finds that purpose again, we see it finally get shaved and brightening up. And with his connection to Melanie, who we haven't really talked about too much yet, she trains helper monkeys. And despite having this facility where she's raising the monkeys, which just looked like a barn, and it was, it was shot in a barn. But
She even called it a barn.
Yeah. So she's been raising these monkeys, and they've all been already promised out. But this is where Jeffrey comes in with the lab animal and his lies as well. But that introduces her in helping the monkey and Alan bond and getting one familiar with the other and training both of them really in how this new lifestyle is going to work. There's a big jump in time during those moments, but they don't really make those clear. But clearly that's not going to be an immediate thing that happens.
And it's interesting because she's also the first person who sort of recognizes or acknowledges that he's still a person, even though he can't use his arms or his legs. She treats him like a person all the way through, and that's what establishes that connection that they end up with. She falls in love with the person than his physical aspect or what he can do for her. She just likes him.
This might be the only time, and it probably isn't the only time in film, but it's the only one I've seen thus far where a quadriplegic has sex.
Yeah. One of the very, very few.
Yeah.
And like, it's very
there's
more than
there's water dance is another one. Like,
Sure there are. I just, this is the only one I've seen.
It's like handled very well.
It was handled very, very well. It was subtle, but you knew what was happening. And and I think that's where you leave that ambiguous ending again, is like, well, they can be intimate. It may not necessarily be a great experience for him, but he can still offer her things that she might want in a relationship.
Yeah, and I mean, I think if you read about some of this stuff, he's not completely out of other things that can happen. Like, I don't think his penis is like completely out of play, depending on what happens. Yeah, no, I like the establishment, but I have a question for everybody here, the guys.
Sure.
when she goes over to his house and uses a straight razor to shave him, are straight razors just everywhere? Because this happens a lot in movies where people just happen to have one lying around. And I don't see them that often.
It might have been a little more common in the 80s, but never had one in my house growing up. Never had one myself. I do have one straight razor, and it's a movie prop. So it's not even a functional razor. It's all dulled.
It's like the baguette in the grocery bag, but with men's shaving. That's yes. What I feel it is. It's a trope that shouldn't be there.
Now, I will say that that is one of the best ways to get off a full beard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't pull on it like a safety razor would. An electric razor isn't going to do anything until you've like trimmed it down to a short enough length to cut. So that might be why they use it. But it's, yeah, you're right. It is very tropey, and it is the baguette.
Okay.
Well,
okay,
and
cool.
And I also understand, because that the nicking of the blood that comes out when she realizes that he's bleeding, and then Ella does as well. That's something Ella reacts to. And monkeys in general, you don't want to be shooting and somebody's bleeding or having their period, by the way. I've heard stories of on set where people lied about their period and then an animal went apeshit. So you never want to actually be bleeding around an animal, especially monkeys and apes, because they will go savage on you and beat the shit out of you. Then you start smelling like prey.
Yeah, I don't know if that's it. It's pheromonal. Like, it's not the same as regular blood.
Yeah. I think in this particular case, it was Ella concerned. It's like, oh, you just hurt Alan. So it's one of those subtle buildups of, like, the animal disliking Kate McNeil, Melanie. And there are other things. Even a little bit later in the movie, they've sent Ella, just before they send Ella away to be looked at by Jeffrey, when Alan starts realizing something's happening, it's affecting my emotions, I think it killed Dr. John Weissman and Linda, I think it burned them, that's when we see it jump up and swipe away Melanie's hand when Melanie was holding Alan's hand. We're starting to really see there's a jealousy aspect kicking up here.
Yeah, and it's so well done. It's just kudos to that, to the trainers and the animal performers, how well they evoked all of that emotion, as Jeff said, in a non-verbal performance.
There's a disclaimer right at the beginning of the movie that they were well trained and no mistreatment of animals happened on this set. And it just goes to show you, I mean, we've seen animal performances before. We don't really see a lot of that now, because of CGI kind of taking over, and you can have the animals do whatever you want, and they're not argumentative because of it, because they're not real.
Well, not just
real.
That, you're also not putting them in danger.
You're not, and I do appreciate that enhancement. If you do it well, it comes off well. And it's not like Rise of the Planet of the Apes could have happened with real apes, at least not without a lot of fucking effort. So there's something to be said for that. But at the same time, there's something about seeing a real animal do that and reacting real. Like that monkey's very expressive as well, which I really enjoyed.
What I hate was when, like, Jeffrey was taking Ella away to look at her, and just her resisting and, like, the audio of the screams, that made me so upset. Like, I don't know why, it just did something to me. I'm like, oh, I know she's the villain in this movie, but I feel really unhappy
and
for
right
now.
I wonder if our audience feels the same way, because I opened up the show with that.
I don't think Ella is the villain. I think science is the villain.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Oh, it is.
You know,
she's a victim just as much as everybody else in this movie.
Yeah, no, she's a lab animal and a victim of Jeffrey's experiments. I don't think Jeffrey's malicious, but he's certainly insensitive about that as well. He's very selfish about his experiment, and he's lying to his friend about the experiments. He lied to Melanie, saying no experiments were done, and he's hiding it from his also selfish boss, who's even worse.
That scene where Jeffrey was going towards Ella in the kitchen, and she was like not wanting to be close to him because he just hurt her, like that was a very distressing.
Yeah, reacting to the inoculations, being hurt, and then we see her get more aggressive in the home, and then later addicted.
Yeah.
Well, so we're seeing a big evolution to Ella and her reactions to the serum. And
now, I have a question about that. Sorry, you go ahead, Trish.
Sorry, I have a question about that. A, Jeffrey needs to get much better at giving needles, because he's not good. Like, he just, like, jabs it in there. It's like, it's a little monkey. It'll get in the skin. It's fine. But then when he takes the serum, he has to do the whole, like, heroin addict, like right in the vein thing. I'm like, well, if it has to go in the vein, then maybe you should have been doing that the whole time, dude.
Yeah, why did you just stick it in the thigh? You didn't really give a shit where you were sticking Ella.
Yeah, right? Exactly. But my other question, too, is now, is she addicted or is she now realizing that that's what's making her smarter?
Mm-hmm. I mean, both things can be true, but they do establish that she wants it. It's something that's, and this is where I find like the movie isn't as strong as the first two acts, is when she starts craving it, or at least Jeffrey voices that as a concern. He's prepping the needle and she's not shying away from it now. And
but that could just be embedding. Like maybe Sam has something there where like Ella has gotten to a point where she's hit a wall and she's smart enough to realize that the serum is what's been able to get her to this point. So she's now at a point where she needs something extra. So she needs to get the serum.
Because she has motive now. Like she's established that she is motivated by things other than food or sleep or hunger or whatever the case may be. She has emotional motive. At least that's what I took away from it, was that she was smart enough to realize that that's what was making her smarter than, or giving her the ability to do these things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I agree.
Okay, well, I think as much as we can talk about this movie for all day, I think, because there's so much to talk about, we should get into some remake territory. We've kind of touched on some things. Now, I was dabbling with my casting, and you know, you guys might have your own ideas, but I was thinking about, and I generally kind of hate when movies do this, but I think it could be effective on an emotional standpoint by doing some gender flipping here with our main character. And I was thinking, because we had that kind of tragedy where the accident happened and then the girlfriend left with the doctor and obviously was less interested in her boyfriend because of the accident. Now, we could still have an accident, but I was thinking that she could be pregnant. Whether the boyfriend wanted it or not is something that's up for discussion, but the loss causes that rift and we can still have that separation.
Without sort of forcing it into sort of this relationship between her and the doctor, or him and the doctor. I actually prefer that. I think that you're, and I can just flip my Melanie and my Alan to make that work.
Well, that's really interesting, because that's great motivation. I was kind of leaning towards like casting a bunch of black people, but
I actually thought about it at that one point where I was thinking of like, well, we could take this in a Jordan Peele direction, who would be a great director for something like this.
Yes.
And I was initially thinking along those lines, but I'm like, you know, it's the emotional stuff that's really engaging in this movie. And to still have some of those tragedies while still trying to make it a different dynamic. And I thought the gender switch might have been the strongest way to do that.
Now, there's also a lot, like in doing a gender switch, there's a lot of like additional subtext that just already comes built in. Like, you know, like a woman who's a quadriplegic and everyone's waiting on her. Like, just everything takes on an entirely different lens because the main character would be a woman and in a, you know, like a victim position.
And they have entirely different needs than a man might, too. Well, not entirely, but a lot of, there's some things that I would anticipate are more challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, the whole bit, too, like, I mean, I can see the rage you would feel. It's like going, you know what, before this happened, nobody fucking listened to me. And now this has happened and it's just worse. Like, I felt powerless before. Now I feel even more powerless. But when Ella kind of opens that up where she can get shit done, you can make it really terrifying.
Well, because, you know, in the depiction of film, the only other, like, female character who becomes a quadriplegic that I can think of kills herself in Million Dollar Baby, so.
I keep thinking of Boxing Helena as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Which was a pretty uncomfortable movie as well.
But we noticed somebody didn't want to be associated with that. That was a whole thing.
Yeah. Now, this kind of does away with, unless we turn, like, Dr. Weissman female, but I didn't want, I kind of wanted to do away with the whole, his doctor was cheating with his ex.
The only thing that adds is like, for him to be suspicious of the doctor, to come from a point where it could be jealousy, is enough of a reason to write off his concerns when he is right, I think, in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Now, like, what I was thinking, I mean, like I said before, I think misdiagnosis is enough to cause the anger, but
Oh, for sure.
If you had a male misogynist doctor who may be getting inappropriate with a patient who can't do anything about it.
Oh, that'd be so uncomfortable.
It would be very uncomfortable, especially in a horror movie like this. Then you're kind of rooting for Ella on that one.
And there's another thing about that, too. Speaking like just as a woman, sometimes you go to doctors and like your concerns aren't, they don't take it seriously. They're like, oh, yeah, it's just a little bit of pain. I'm like going, no, it is a lot of fucking pain. You don't like this has been consistently studied. So it sort of brings that whole bit in where it's like this misogynist like doesn't really believe her. So, of course, he's going to misdiagnose her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Totally. Like, that happens all the time. That's, like, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and it's something people can associate with. I mean, it happens to male patients as well. I just had one a few months ago where the doctor was on his cell phone the whole time, and I'm like, what just happened? Nothing. I had to go to somebody else. Yeah. But it's like, okay, there are shitty doctors out there. It happens.
There are a lot.
Well, and this doctor's arrogant.
Yeah.
Right? And
I think that's important, too, is because he's young. And he's fresh as a doctor. He's maybe his bedside manner's not good or whatever, but he's young, he's overconfident, and missing stuff because he thinks he's rules the roost because he's so good, he's fresh out of school or whatever. Uh-huh. A lot of these doctors think they know everything, and they're just starting to learn, really, when it comes to more of the subtleties of dealing with patients.
They all think that they're house, and they're not.
Yeah. Yeah, there are definitely a lot of doctors that have shitty bedside manners. But yeah, so I thought maybe shifting the gender could really change this movie and still keep it familiar at the same time.
I agree. I think that it adds enough just because of the current, climate that we live in and everything else. I think it would be the thing that you could justify there being a remake over. Because it does add a lot, and it does have it opens up an interesting conversation. Because otherwise, it is a really good movie, and I was having a hard time justifying remaking it.
So. Yeah, I was too, and there was actually a different angle that I thought was pretty good that I had, after I watched it, and then I didn't jot it down, and it was completely out of my head the next day, and I still don't remember what it was. but then the gender thing occurred to me when I was doing my casting yesterday, and I'm like, oh, that could be interesting, and normally that's something I don't like in a horror movie. Like, it didn't work when we did The Hitcher in my mind, but it could really work here.
Yeah, because it's a different kind of story.
Yeah, right? And I mean, I would want to switch the gender of the monkey as well, because establishing that rare moment where, if he's experimenting on animals, male or female, maybe he's got a 50-50 or whatever, and this one's reacting to it. So when we establish that male monkeys can be a little more aggressive, that works to our advantage.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could just change the name to Boo and have a nice little tribute.
Yeah.
Yeah, but see, I kind of like the fact that Ella was, female. I mean, if you're going to make it a female woman, it's kind of the whole bit of, it sort of undermines her power if it's, another man fighting her battles, even though it is a monkey.
Well, yeah, you might be right there. And honestly, I do find, females... Well, that's not true, because cats, usually the females are the bitches. But but with dogs, it's usually the females are a little more affectionate.
But it could be this bonding, this helper monkey wants to do things for her because she kind of understands her position.
Hmm.
I think that's what females bond.
Yeah.
I was going to say, that could actually feed really well, because up to this point, Ella has only been in contact with men, and all they've done is stick her with needles and make her do things that she doesn't want to do. And then she gets in with our Ellen character, Ellen, that's not going to work. But anyhow, she has this character who actually shows genuine affection for her, and she starts to do things because she wants to, not because she has to.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'd like to pull in the mom who's probably never really affectionate growing up, but has become overly so and overly concerned, as a mother would maybe in one of these circumstances. And we can still play with the nurse as well in a very similar situations where even the women in her life are failing her.
Yes. I actually had an idea. What if it's a stepmother? Because that then fixes my casting problem.
Oh, sure. it doesn't really matter that much. But if her father's gone, because there was no father figure. Why is it always in these movies there's only one parent? But
casting, right? Cheaper.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think
it's a legendary restriction.
Yeah, but I think a stepmother could sort of help establish that sort of relationship that they're not close because they're not actually blood related, but the stepmother really somehow desperately wants to be connected to her stepchild because she's been part of her life for so long, mm-hmm. but still doesn't get how to be a parent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one that wasn't there to raise her, and that's what makes the whole situation uncomfortable, is they didn't have that connection.
It's like the mother is seeing this as her opportunity to raise her for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's... Yeah. It actually creates a new dynamic there that's, mm-hmm. that could be really interesting and explains the dynamic as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the infantilizing nature of like, oh, now I can take care of you from the start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very interesting angle, and it still preserves a lot of the plot of the movie. And I mean, we haven't done anything that really changes a lot, but at the same time, through the different dynamic, it'll just change organically because of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of dig it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it a lot. I think that it, a lot of the concepts and, like, because Romero was a very socially conscious director. Mm-hmm. And I feel like at the time he was talking about things that needed to be talked about. But I think that really in this case, if you were to gender flip it, like, all of the dialogue that this movie would have would be relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, marginalizing disabled people still happens. And yeah. it's just not talked about anymore, gets swept under the rug by the next thing.
And getting talked down to, like, it's the whole thing where his body doesn't work. And that's the only part that's different. But it's this whole thing. You see somebody in a chair. And for some reason, people think they're mentally feeble.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like just people's tendency to talk slower.
And we can still have moments of, you know, the strength of that character, especially when if we do make her female, where she does speak up. It's like, I'm not deaf. I'm not retarded. I am in a chair. You can still uh-huh. talk to me like I'm a person, and having some of those more humorous moments at times where it's the people around them are realizing they have changed the way they talk to this person. And that's something I admire about Jeffrey. He doesn't change. I wish we would have seen the uh-huh. characters interact once before the accident so we yes. could see if that was, but I do get the sense that the character never changed in his behavior. He's late to the welcome home party. Everybody's laughed when he shows up, and it feels like, yep, nope, this is still same old Jeffrey doing Jeff things. And he's obviously yeah. close enough that he has his own key and everything. So,
and I mean, he doesn't care. I mean, he's got that beat up old car with the door that won't close. Yeah. Those moments of humor with him were part of the movie that kind of broke some of that tension so that when the tense moments happened, they were really tense.
Yeah, yeah, he may be the mad scientist cliche, but he doesn't come off as a cliche. He does come off as an actual person who's got his own problems. You know, he's doping himself up to stay awake for 3 days at a time so he can just get more work done. You know, so it's going to affect somebody on a personality level, and that makes him a little bit eccentric. And uh-huh. that what's kind of what makes the character likable as well. It's like, well, we can see where maybe this is going to fall apart a little bit because he just doesn't have his shit together.
No.
I think that ultimately with a movie like Monkey Shines, you want the whole thing to just be a tragedy. Like, you want everybody to be, you know, to have their goals and to be trying their best, but it's not like anybody is, you know, the cut and clear villain of the movie.
Yes.
Okay, well, I think it's we've got something fairly cohesive here. Let's move into some casting. Now, I'm sure none of you casted with this female character in mind, but let's hear what you've got in store. Let's start with Jeff.
Ooh. You know, so initially, I think that if you were actually I do have a good casting. I can just change pretty much one character, just the main character, and everything else works. Oh my goodness, I can't remember her name now, and I'm terrible. But the woman who played Domino in Deadpool 2 is also in Atlanta.
Zazie Beetz.
She's incredible. And she's, you know, an up-and-coming actress. I think that she would be really great, which works really well, because I wanted her mother to be played by Angela Bassett.
Nice.
I was thinking for Jeffrey, I was kind of thinking that we could lean a little bit more into him being an older character, like, and cast someone like Willem Dafoe, just because... I think it would add an interesting dynamic. And also, I just watched Spider-Man. Not saying that that's, you know, but he would be great.
I like the idea of maybe being this old family friend who's almost like a surrogate father to him.
Yeah, that's uh-huh. kind of what I was thinking. Yeah, so Willem Dafoe, I think, as Jeffrey would be pretty good. Yeah, those were really the three main people I was casting. Just because usually with movies like this, I don't like to lean into casting every character, just because, I mean, I know we don't think about budget, but usually I like movies that really focus on just a couple core characters, and those are the people that usually make a movie really sing, like not the character actors. You know what I mean. That said, I think you
nobody could, knows you what could, you're talking about.
you could recast. Goodness, terrible with names. The guy who was in Get Out.
Oh, Daniel Kaluuya.
No, like the older guy who's already in this movie.
Oh, Stephen Root. About him. Stephen Root.
Yes, thank you. Oh my goodness. Yeah, you could recast Stephen Root in this movie pretty easily, I think.
I did. I just kept him in Dean Burnabridge's role.
Yeah,
perfect.
Yeah, I thought about it.
Same role.
I didn't, but you could easily keep him in the same role, and it'd be fine. And he's even better now. So,
yes,
and give him more to do too.
I would actually switch him in over to the Dr. Williams role.
Ooh, interesting.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah. Because that was a part of what I did like. You had the younger, overconfident doctor, which was understated within the movie, but I think we talked about it here. And then he gets the second opinion from an older, more established doctor who does find what's missed. And I think that's kind of something that was something I liked and wanted to preserve in my casting. So
mm-hmm. I did that as well, but in a different way.
Anything else there, Jeff?
Yeah, I was kind of thinking about directors, and mostly I know this might be... Like, it feels like it's a cop-out choice, but I was really feeling like Mick Flanagan, just entirely because of Hush.
Funny, that's who I picked as my director as well.
Yeah, because, like, Hush is such a good movie. Yeah, exactly. Like, that atmosphere is exactly what you want.
Oh, you know, if somebody's going to remake it well, Mike Flanagan would be all over it. It's actually something I actually didn't consider, but having seen Hush, it makes a whole lot of sense for sure.
Yeah, like, they're different movies, but he has the right sensibilities to really, like, make a movie like this. Not only really good, because he's a great director, but also incredibly tense.
Yeah. Well, and he's also good at acknowledging disabilities and making them work in context with a film.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the series with the house, the haunted house that he did?
Haunting of Hill House.
Haunting of Hill House. He's also good at adding real much needed emotion in a horror genre.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Like Annabelle Creation, which I believe, no, that was David F. Sandberg. He did Ouija, Origin of Evil. Even that movie... For a series, like the first movie is kind of like a by the numbers type thing, and watching him approach the exact same subject matter and bring in all of this like family emotional storytelling and all of the like just the way that he approached the exact same material and all the deftness he handled it with.
Well, he understands why Stephen King works so well as well. It's mm-hmm. not just it's not the horror and the weirdness that comes in the beyond reality stuff that creeps into those stories. It's the people and the people reacting to those situations. That's why the two mesh so well and have worked together several times already and probably will continue to have pairings, is because they both have that way of telling stories already inherent in them. And this works well here.
He did a Gerald's Game too, didn't he?
Yeah.
And yeah, like, but Gerald's Game is another great example of the type of movie that like a director directing a person who's tied up in a bed and can't move for a whole movie as well. Like, this is a perfect director for a Monkey Shines movie.
Yeah, yeah. The more we talk about it, the more I am sold on it. That all you got there?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
let's move on to Trish here. What do you got for us?
Okay. Well, I was looking at my casting, and we could probably flip these, and this would work. So originally for Alan Mann, I had Patrick Schwarzenegger, because I thought, who would be like young and arrogant and then have this really take him down? And it would be very interesting to see.
Interesting.
Because like he's a very physical looking guy and his dad is, and it's just a whole thing. But you know what? I would flip him and make him the doctor if I could.
Mm-hmm.
And then for in the chair for the girlfriend, Ritu Arya, she's from Feel Good and Umbrella Academy.
Okay.
She's quite good.
Who is she in Umbrella Academy?
In Umbrella Academy, she is.
She's a Ellen Page's Lyra character.
Well, I know it's not Ellen Page.
Yeah, she's Lila Pitts, is what it says.
Okay. I'm just trying to picture her because I have seen the series, but wasn't
she? Yeah, she's Lava and Feel Good. Okay. I've binged Feel Good and I thought she was really good in it.
Cool.
And then for Fisher, I actually did a gender swap on that and I made it Mia Wasikowska. Thought that'd be interesting. Melanie Parker, I cast as Gugu Mbatha Raw because I love her and I was watching her on the morning show and she was great. For Dorothy Mann, I actually did a weird thing where I went a lot older and I made it kind of the character's grandmother.
Okay.
And so I went with Holland Taylor and she was like the mother on Two and a Half Men. You've seen her everywhere.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I know who she is. Yeah.
Movies. Dan Burbage, I left to Stephen Root.
Okay.
And then when I cast the brain, which is where I got the idea that the brain had something to do with the whole behavior.
Mm-hmm. No, I like and that. I think we should keep that in our remake or awesome. Add that into our remake. A little bit of backstory about where the brain came from.
The brain. And I cast Fairuza Balk as the brain.
Oh, genius.
Nice.
And then for the director, I went with Karen Kusama because of The Invitation.
Ooh, very good.
Because that one, I'm still so unsettled by it.
Right.
And it's just building a claustrophobic feeling of tension. Like she used that. That's just like one place, one house, and building that claustrophobia. And that's kind of what this movie does as well. So that's what I was thinking.
Very good. Great casting. And Samuel, what do you got for us?
Okay, so I'm just going to flip my Melanie and Alan.
Okay.
Because it still works for me. For the sake of argument, I was going to call Alan Melanie and Melanie Alan. So my Melanie, I cast Kat Graham. She is not really recognizable, but she was one of the main characters in Vampire Diaries. And she's been working, she does a lot of voice work and stuff too. So I was interested to sort of see what she could do with a supporting role, but now she's a lead role, so even better. For my Alan, I cast Ty Sheridan from Ready Player One.
Okay.
Right, I wanted somebody who's maybe looked like they would be in law school and around that 23, 24 years old age for that character. Kat Graham's a little bit older, but still looks like the right age. For my Jeffrey, I agreed that because he is an established research scientist, he needed to be a little bit older. I didn't go quite as old as Willem Dafoe, but I did go with an actor in his mid to late 30s. I went with Drake Bell from the Disney TV series because I wanted somebody who's kind of had that John Pankow look almost and who was capable, deft with comedy. So I thought he could do that quite well as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because he actually is quite funny in Josh and Drake. That's what it was. For my Dorothy, I did go a little bit older than I originally intended, but I just wanted her. So I went with Jennifer Tilly.
Okay.
Nice.
I think she'd be great, especially considering she's now a stepmother. I think that she'd be a great kind of shrill stepmother character.
I think it works better, though.
Yeah. For my Dean Burbage, as I mentioned, we went with Stephen Root. I did cast my Dr. Wiseman. I went Justin Timberlake. I thought he could do smarmy, arrogant really well. And he's a good actor. He's actually quite a talented actor.
Yeah.
For my Dr. Williams, the older doctor who discovers Dr. Wiseman's error, I recast John Pankow in that role. So I was thinking the same way you were, Jay, but just did a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
I did cast the nurse. I wanted Kate Mucci.
Okay, cool.
I mean, she does do comedy more, so I think that you could sort of lean into that a little bit with her character where she's still funny but not in the right way. And then, as I mentioned, my director was Mike Flanagan.
Very good.
It's actually, I forgot to mention, I was thinking Angelica Houston for The Caretaker. Not just because they have similar haircuts, but, Angelica Houston should be in more movies. And yes. She has that stern, like, she knows what's best for you kind of vibe, so.
Right.
She really does.
But I have a problem. If she's still working now, something went very wrong with her life. She didn't save anybody.
Okay, now it's time for my casting here. As always, I did the most, but you know what? I forgot to cast the Linda character, but I think everybody else did too, so it's fine.
Nice.
I went with, because I did do the gender swap in mind when I did my casting, so for my Alan character, who I've now named Alana, it is Alicia Vikander. I was still trying to keep the age group around the same in the early 20s. And somebody who was really fit, so if we still wanted to make her an athlete, great. If not, doesn't matter. But I liked how the tragedy of somebody using their career as something physical
It
just adds to everything along with it. But Alicia Vikander, I think, is bound for great things, and I thought this would be a great opportunity for her. For Jeffrey, I wanted to keep that similar look and feel, and what better kind of best friend slash, and maybe there's even romantic interest in there as well, where he's a little jealous of the situation, but the friend who's been friend-zoned. I was thinking of Bill Skarsgård for Jeffrey, and most people will think of him as Pennywise these days, but I like his look, and I thought that would be kind of cool.
And he was pretty good in that show that Eli Roth did on Netflix.
Oh, yes. I'm trying to remember what it was called. I really
Hollow Grove?
something like that. It wasn't Hollow Grove, but I quite enjoyed it with the vampires and the werewolves. I did like that series.
Oh, that's Hemlock Grove.
Hemlock.
Yes, Hemlock Grove. Yeah, Bill Skarsgård was a good actor in that show. He was one of the highlights. So
yeah. For the Melanie character, who I've now just named Mel because I've made that character male, I went with Dev Patel from Slumdog Millionaire. For Dr. Weissman, again, I wanted the young, arrogant doctor, much like Sam wanted. I went with Taron Egerton from The Kingsman.
That's good.
Oh, he'd be really good in that.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that'd be a good change of role for him, too, because he's sort of being played the likable kind of guy. It'd be fun to see him play something else.
Yeah, exactly. Instead of the heroic character, be a little smarmy, because he does come off a little smarmy at times. So even in Kingsman, so I'm like, let's play into that a little bit.
In Kingsman, he's not that likable. Just
saying it. For Dorothy, the mom, I went with Toni Collette, thinking about the performance in Hereditary and being this emotional piece. And I wanted to draw that out, which also connects to my director, who is Ari Aster. And he's so good at adding tragedy to his horror. And that's why I picked him. Still got a little more casting here, though. For Dean Burbage, I went with Brian Cox from Autopsy of Jane Doe. He's got a very similar type of character to Stephen Root. So casting-wise, it's great, but he could have just kept Stephen in there as well. For Marianne, the nurse, I kind of wanted to give her a more malevolent look, even though she doesn't do anything too horrible. I went with Michelle Gomez, who you can currently see in the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, and she was also Missy in Doctor Who. For Doc Williams, who's also my last one, I went with, because I wanted an older guy, but somebody who was very likable as well, I went John Hannah from the Mummy movies.
Well, that's a nice choice.
Yeah. And it's one of those characters that come in so late that it's like, damn it, I want to see more of that person. Why didn't you bring him in earlier?
Yeah. And he's an older guy now, so he's about the right age to do this.
Yeah, no,
not
I was thinking
too old, but still working.
Yeah, I was thinking of that as well. It's like, here's this actor who I still love to see and can still be in these great older role parts. And he was just in S.H.I.E.L.D. a couple of years ago as well as a scientist character. Yeah. So still somebody I love seeing when they pop up from time to time.
Awesome.
Yeah, so I think we had some really good casting there. And hopefully we came up with enough ideas to kind of make it new and fresh for a new generation. This one was a toughie. I got through it and it was like, oh, I'm glad I gave this a day to sit on because I don't know what to do with this.
Yeah, it was partially the reason I really, really wanted us to tackle it, because it is kind of a movie that's tough to tackle for a remake.
But we did identify some of the problems with it as well, and I think we've fixed most of them. I don't think we really fixed the problem with Dean Burbage necessarily, but that was the only thing we didn't really address.
No, we didn't, and maybe that was on purpose because there was just so much going on that you can honestly leave it out. The threat of shutting it down or destroying the animals because the scientist Jeffrey isn't producing might be enough.
And that's what I was just about to say, is establish that there's pressure on Jeffrey to produce results, and he wants to protect his one success, which is Ella, and that's why he does what he does instead of this whole story about the even eviler evil scientist.
Yeah, it just simplifies that story while still kind of keeping it there.
And it adds more motivation for Jeffrey.
Yeah.
And it's one of those motivations, like with research, it's so hard because you need the time to get the results and make sure you're getting the results you're supposed to get and make sure you followed everything so that you can repeat it and make sure that this is right. But all the time, the research is people like, I'm giving you money. What? Why haven't you given me anything? And it's sort of like they're constantly fighting with that whole money thing, which is just, that's something to illustrate in this movie. That's just what happens. It really does.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And it really simplifies that and tightens up the story just a little bit because then you're not dealing with that backstory quite so much.
Yeah.
I mean, you could still have the bit where the dean has gone into his lab and taken all of his research because he needs to show some results and he's pulled it just because he needs to look at it and go, okay, well, can I still justify this funding?
Yeah,
we could accomplish the same thing with Jeffrey going to his lab and seeing that it's gone and then finding out from somebody like all of that information, like very quick and move on.
Mm-hmm. I would actually just get rid of, like, rather than have the scene where the monkeys are running rampant, I would just have the whole lab been cleaned out.
Yeah.
It's like he's been shut down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was warned and he's been shut down, which is a good thing. His experiment is off site now. And
yeah,
we've seen this similar plot work in Rise of the Planet of the Apes. So
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It does work. Yeah, this was a fun episode. I'm glad we got to do it. It was a toughie for us, but we got through Monkey Shines in 1988, mm-hmm. our third entry into Prime April Ape Apocalypse.
1988.
Oh, very good. Very, very good.
That's still one per episode.
We have been fairly pun light when it's seems to be just sitting there waiting for us.
We don't get the low hanging fruit.
I do.
Sorry, not
okay. Oh yeah, you totally do, Jay.
my favorite low hanging fruit are bananas.
So I'm going to interrupt. I just wanted to add something. This is one movie where I was watching it and then I found out about the argument about the cut. And it's one of those movies where we've done, and I'm like, well, you know, I just would love to get my hands on a director's cut of this movie, because I feel I like George A. Romero and I know that there's some answers in there, and it bothers me that I can't get to them.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that that's not going to happen, but maybe he's got some notes lying around and somebody can reconstruct, assuming the footage still exists somewhere, and reconstruct a intended director's cut.
Oh, it's
that would be pretty cool. Yeah, no, it'd be pretty cool. And if everybody else would like to see it, let us know. Let us know your favorite ape and monkey movies, and maybe we will do a round two next year. You can chime in on your favorite primate movies and simian movies in the comments on all our social media, at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and invasiontheremake@gmail.com. So send us your requests, your suggestions, your comments, or just if you want to have a chat with us, we'd be happy to talk movies with you and maybe get some new ideas for some new episodes down the road. We do have a fan challenge coming up in May, so we're always listening, and if we like what you have to throw down at us, it might be turned into a future episode. Make sure you tell your friends and family about the show, and while you're on your devices, leave us a 5-star rating and a short review over on Apple Podcasts or the podcast app of your choice that you are currently using. And we're, like I said at the top of the show, we're on Spotify now, so you can follow us there and even frickin' YouTube by following us there and ringing that bell for notifications. We also have a Central Hub website. Sam, give them that website.
It is invasionoftheremake.wixsite.com/podcast. Go there. It's fun.
Yes, it's fun, and all the episodes are there. Or you can find us on our Libsyn as well, which is Libsyn/invasionoftheremake. So that was our third entry into the Apocalypse. Yes, we know this wasn't an ape. Don't be a dick.
It's primate.
It's
in the title.
Now it's
we know
primate.
It's not an ape.
We know it's not an ape. But we definitely have some apes for you next week. I think it's a fairly obvious one, but you're all been like, when are you doing it? When are you doing it? It's happening next week. I'm not going to tell you just yet, but I'm sure if you take a wild stab at it, you'll probably be right.
As long as
you don't guess the thing.
No, it's not the thing. There's no monkeys or apes in that movie. Yeah. Not happening.
I mean, that would be an interesting add to the thing.
Oh my goodness. They're training helper monkeys in the Antarctic.
Yes.
Because they work so well in the frozen tundra.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I'd be amused to see it. That'd be more of a throwback to the ludicrous 40s and 50s science fiction movies for sure. We should have remade that one with like ape body and the Martian helmet.
Oh yeah,
isn't that an Ed Wood film?
Maybe it was. I don't know. Remember?
Is that movie The One-Eyed Monster or something?
I don't
remember. Something like that.
Chime in on the comments, guys, because I don't know exactly which 50s sci-fi movie. Everybody kind of knows it, but I don't remember what movie it was in. I'm sure it was a Mystery Science Theater on that one. I'll have to do some more research for it. Maybe if we do a round two next year, we'll add that one in. Who knows? But until next week, I've been Jason.
I'm always Sam.
I continue to be Trish.
And I'm always Jeff Omega.
And we are out of here.
Get away from me! Get away from me! Get away from me! Slime. You filth. I'm gonna take you apart. I'm gonna rip your fucking eyes out. I'm gonna tear you open and chew out your fucking heart.